Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear a podcast interview from the Boiling Frog series, co-hosted with my friend Sabelle Edmonds. And our guest today is Cindy Cohn, the very influential fighter for our constitutional rights. She is the legal director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we'll recap the important events of 2013 and the legal standing for a number of lawsuits, which is now provided by the documents disclosed by Edward Snowden. That's straight ahead in our in-depth interview. I want to thank the people who support my efforts here at peterbcollins.com by subscribing. People like James Quigley in Ireland, Jens Van Nielsen, who is in Scandinavia, if I recall correctly, and some fine Americans like Joe Clarici and Gene Kenny. You can join their ranks. Just go to peterbcollins.com, and under my picture on the homepage, follow the links that say sign up. Our subscriptions start at $5 a month. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and we have just renewed the bonus offer of a bag of Kona coffee beans, the kick-ass Kona beans, that are grown by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. There's a shipment on the way, and if you're a new annual subscriber, I will save a bag for you. I also have a bonus book, and I won't name the title because I'm not sure what my inventory is right now, but I'll be happy to send a bonus book if you become a new annual subscriber today. Just follow the information at peterbcollins.com. And also, check on our homepage. If you follow the links to audible.com, you can get yourself a free audiobook download, and Audible will pay me $15 if you take out a 30-day trial subscription. All the details on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today returns. Cindy Cohn is legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, based in San Francisco. Cindy, always a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for the work that you and your colleagues do.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we've got a lot to catch up on. We're speaking here in the last week or two of 2013, and it's been quite a tumultuous year for the Bill of Rights, for our efforts to fight back against the creeping surveillance state and what I call a creeping police state. And you have been on the forefront with legal actions, and we've also benefited from the sacrifice of some whistleblowers, including Chelsea Manning and Ed Snowden. As you look back at this year, what are the high points and what do you see as promising developments?
Well, obviously, I think that for those of us at EFF who've been trying to draw attention to and get accountability for the NSA spying since, well, at least 2006, the Snowden revelations were a game changer. Not only because of the wealth of information that they revealed to the American people and, you know, keep revealing. I don't think they're done yet. They're not even close. But what they did was they really changed the national debate because the government stopped trying to claim national security state secrets and stop all discussion of what was going on and turned and, you know, admitted it. and started defending it in court and in the court of public opinion as well. Now, they're still playing a lot of games. I don't mean to indicate that they're not, but it really is a game changer to shift from fighting over whether this is all too secret to be decided or even discussed to one where they're actually defending what they're doing, and we can really see their legal arguments and their you know, public arguments. And frankly, you know, the American people aren't buying it. We have the majority of the American people now, for the first time since the information was revealed in 2006 about the spying, we have a majority of the American people saying that the NSA has gone too far and it's time to reset the pendulum. So that's just a huge, huge change. We also had a great...
Cindy, if yeah. I may, you're an attorney, and in the simplest terms, Ed Snowden, his last name is seven letters, and the word standing is seven letters. And to me, that is the most powerful effect of his whistleblowing actions. And we saw it just a few days ago as Judge Richard Leon issued a blistering decision based on what he considered to be a kind of wobbly claim from Larry Klayman, who said he'd been messed with by the NSA. But earlier this year, we saw important cases being thrown out because of the standing issue or not accepted by the Supreme Court because they could narrowly say there was no proof of standing. And yep. And so to me, that as a layperson, that's the most powerful effect. Is that your opinion?
I think that's exactly right. I think that the shift to a discussion about whether this is happening and whether anybody can challenge it to one where the question is whether this is okay or not. This is the kind of world we want to live in, the kind of country we want to live in, is just a tremendous shift. And, you know, it's kind of a breath of fresh air for those of us who've been kind of laboring. I mean, you guys have always cared about this, Peter, but, you know, trying to get the broader public's attention to this story has been a big job. And now, you know, we've got the public's attention.
Well, and just this year, just a year ago at this time in December, John Eisenberg, the attorney who had carried the case of the Al Haramain charity that won a district court judgment in favor of the plaintiffs, establishing that they had been wrongfully wiretapped, he decided not to pursue appeals because of the standing issue. And so it really does represent a sea change. And I'm curious what other suits are in the pipeline from EFF or from other like-minded groups that will take advantage of the standing issue now that it is effectively resolved.
Honestly, the Al Haramain case did go forward, and they lost on a government immunity question in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So they did appeal that decision, and they lost on a really weird legal technicality in the statute.
Understood.
Which is also a tragedy, but a very different one than a standing one. But,
okay, I take your point, but Eisenberg did decline to further appeal it because he was afraid of setting a bad precedent.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. EFF has, since 2006, we've had a lawsuit against the NSA spying. It's had to shift a little bit given some things that Congress did. But we have a case called Jewell versus NSA that is has been suing over the phone records collection and the upstream collection, the access to the fiber optic cables at the AT&T building here in San Francisco and across the country since 2008. And that case continues. And in fact, we actually won a pretty significant ruling in that case in July that got kind of overshadowed by the Snowden revelations, but is a good thing nonetheless. And then after the Snowden revelations, we decided to bring a new case to talk not just about the Fourth Amendment and the FISA law, which had been the focus of the earlier cases, but to really talk about the First Amendment right of association and how that's impacted by the phone records program. Mm-hmm. And the case is called First Unitarian Church versus the National Security Agency. And we represent 22 different associations. And again, they range from the First Unitarian Church to the California Gun Owners Association, to People for the American Way, to Greenpeace, to Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And all of these groups, they don't agree on policy at all. But what they agree on is that they need to be able to work with people, to associate with people, without the government looking over their shoulder. These are all organizations that are trying to create some kind of political change that the government might not like. And they need to be able to have people associate with them in private. So this is an effort to try to broaden the conversation about the NSA spying beyond the Fourth Amendment and privacy issues to include the First Amendment and free speech issues. And we're currently in the midst of briefs in that case. With a hearing date, sadly not until April, but that will be moving in the spring. So we have two cases going on. We've been part of this huge Stop Watching Us coalition, which organized protests in October in D.C., which has had input into various legislative proposals, some of which are good and some of which are totally rotten, around the NSA spying. And we've also, you know, EFF's a tech organization. We've been working to develop technologies to help people protect themselves against NSA spying as well. So, across all fronts, this is really a front burner issue for EFF.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming back to Ed Snowden, there's no question that he has changed the game. But there are some questions that linger. For example, just to zero in on one, some of the first revelations were slides from a PowerPoint presentation about a program called PRISM, P-R-I-S-M. And to date, I believe we've seen something like 8 out of 45 slides. And I use this as an example because we haven't gotten full disclosure of the trove of documents reportedly copied by Mr. Snowden. The NSA says it can't even estimate how many he gained possession of or copied, which is stunning in itself. They're able to track our moves, but not those of their own employees, apparently.
Yep.
And so are you satisfied with at this stage, and certainly, you know, there's more to be covered in the Snowden materials, but are you satisfied with the level of disclosure and with the manner that the journalists have acted as kind of new gatekeepers to this information?
Well, I think that first of all, the obligation to tell us about their spying isn't the journalist's obligation, right? It should be our government's obligation. So to the extent that I'm frustrated that we still don't know everything the government is doing, I think we need to direct that at the entity that's doing it and that's, you know, tomorrow could reveal to us everything that they've been up to with regard to our communications. And that entity is not the journalists. It is the NSA. And the federal government, and they need to come clean with the American people about what they've been doing. So to the extent that I'm frustrated that we're still trying to piece this picture together through little dribs and drabs of what Mr. Snowden is putting out rather than the NSA actually coming clean with the American people about what they're doing. In terms of the strategy of the journalists to kind of do this in pieces rather than all at once, I think that that's a reasonable strategy. Honestly, it's a lot to swallow and to get your mind around and to begin thinking about. And each one of these revelations takes a while for, I think, to really sink in with the American people. And this is one of the things I think we learned from the WikiLeaks disclosures. You know, when WikiLeaks just dumped all of the diplomatic cables, you know, into the public and some of the other things that they've done, which have been big dumps, you know, it's really been hard for people to get their mind around what's going on and to pick out what's important from all the other stuff that's not there. And I think that that really diminished the value of the WikiLeaks revelations with regard to those of us who are trying to make social change out of it and for the American people trying to get their mind around it. So I think what the journalists are trying to do is to give us pieces that are really much more well thought out. There's a lot of explanation with each one of the news articles. They've got technologists helping them make sense of this and explain it to us. And that just takes time. So I'm perfectly willing to be, I mean, I admit that I'm a little impatient, but I'm willing to be patient because I think they're doing a good job educating the broader public with each one of these revelations than they would do if they just dumped all the slides out. I also think that they're trying to not harm national security, real national security. You know, we all know that the government cries, you know, national security like the boy cries wolf. But that doesn't mean there aren't some national security concerns in some of the information. And I think the journalists are taking their time. They're talking with experts. I think they're regularly talking with the administration to try to make sure that they don't accidentally do something that would really harm national security, and to kind of pay attention to the fact that while the government claims national security when it shouldn't, that doesn't mean there's no national security implications to any of this information. So, you know, I think they're trying to be responsible both to the people and to the actual national security concerns. And if that means we have to be a little more patient with them, I'm okay with that. And honestly, to the extent that people are upset about this, they should be upset with the Obama administration, because they could come clean with us tomorrow.
Cindy, I want to go back to some of your points with the previous topic with courts and victory. What would you consider a real victory, the ultimate victory in all this?
Well, I think that the ultimate victory would be for a declaration from the court that the Fourth Amendment doesn't allow mass surveillance, that surveillance has to be targeted. And that doesn't mean, you know, that targeted means what ordinary people think targeted means, which is that you have to have some level of reasonable suspicion before you get access to people's communications and communications records in the first place. You don't get to scoop it all up first and then second sort out whether something is illegal. I would like to see that as a constitutional matter, because if it's a constitutional matter, it's a lot harder to overturn later. And, recognition is very strong in our culture. You know, secondarily, I would accept something legislative that bans mass surveillance. And I think there are efforts in Congress to try to get there. I don't think anybody's all the way there yet. Certainly, the Feinstein bill is a step in a complete whitewash of what's going on. The Leahy-Sensenbrenner bill is trying, but it's still a little too indirect for me. I would like to see the Leahy-Sensenbrenner bill say that you can't do mass surveillance. Just say it straight up and not play legislative games that the government might misuse. But I think it's trying to do the right thing. And so, you know, we're supportive of it, but we'd like to see it change. So first to me would be a constitutional decision. Second to me would be a legislative decision. And then third thing that I would really like to see is I'd like to see us have a secure internet. I think the technological fixes, you know, we have kind of let our technology be developed in a way that really doesn't take into account our privacy. And the technology could go either way. You know, technology is agnostic. It doesn't care. I would like to see encryption baked into our systems at a level that it isn't now. And I think that, you know, if we get any one of those three things, we would do a good thing. And I think if we really want to be redundant and have real security, we should have all three.
Okay, well, let's say in a perfect world, we get the top two, meaning both in courts have this ultimate victory and we have this powerful, powerful legislation. And let's say the federal government says, okay, we are going to bow and you're absolutely right. And we promise we are going to enforce the stuff you put in place and we're going to observe that. Now, who's going to check the government and see that they are actually complying? Who would be seeing that they are complying? Who oversees all these data collections to know that government is actually complying with the laws, whether those, you know, constitutional ones through the courts, but also the legislative laws?
Well, I think that we need real oversight, you know, the kind of, you know, that we need independent government agencies that can oversee what's going on, and who have the power to go public. You know, we have a pretty good Office of Inspector General on a lot of these that have issued reports about the various kinds of misuse of government surveillance technologies, but they're slow. They don't have a lot of power, and they're all kept secret. I think we need to reform the classification system so that the government really can only classify and keep secret stuff that is actually secret. We need the public to have a good view into what these agencies are doing, and then we need robust oversight that's not captured, right? That isn't, you know, we understand that there are actually some pretty good reports that the Office of Inspector General has done about abuses of the surveillance systems, but they're all still classified, so they never really go anywhere. So I think that if you really want oversight, we have to reform the classification system, and we have to build robust, independent oversight. And then, of course, we have to give people the power to sue. you know, we need, you know, the cases in the Al-Haramain case is a perfect example of a case where they absolutely should have been held to be able to bring that lawsuit. And the way the governmental immunities were written by Congress essentially blocked them from getting justice. And we need to get rid of the governmental immunities that were built up, most of it in the Patriot Act, to prevent ordinary people from seeking accountability when the government abuses them. So there's a whole panoply of things we could do. Right now, we've done almost nothing. So any little steps would make things better. But, you know, I think we're beyond the point where we only ask for baby steps now. We need to ask for huge, giant steps.
I completely agree with you. But theoretically speaking, we already have all these so-called systems in place, as you said, the supposed independent IG. And we have had IG reports, which even the ones that have been strong really didn't mean anything in the end, because you really don't have any power of enforcement. And that is Congress basically shrugging up. And a good example of this would be how the FISA laws were all declared as a huge victory for the public, and there were supposed to be all these mechanisms in place for FISA laws and their implementation. And we have found out that none of those really were enforced. We have found out that the judges in the FISA courts, who are specifically elected, and they are actually appointed to the FISA court because they are pro-federal government and all these secrecies and all the violations, because none of these judges have ever really challenged. When you look at the millions or hundreds of thousands of FISA requests, and when you see the report saying that either one or two or maybe zero have been really questioned or challenged by the so-called courts, federal courts and the judges, and of course we have seen our Congress, this is what I'm afraid of, saying that even if, you know, especially with organizations and civil liberties related activists, the victory is declared, it is would be so premature, because we really, if you look at it theoretically, we have this perfect system supposedly in place. I mean, first of all, we have the Constitution. We have our own, like the basic constitution there, that is the law of land here in this country. Well, that really hasn't mattered to the government. We do have this so-called courts and the FISA judges that their job is supposed to be. So what if that's the thing that makes me cynical, saying even if the government were to come out and say, you know what, you're right, let's put some of these, and we say, okay, we are going to do it, people are going to go back, say, okay, now we are safe, as we felt that way under these FISA laws that we had. And in the end, in the actuality, really, there won't be anything different.
Well, you know, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And I think that anybody who thinks that we can just do a couple things and then we can forget about it and go about our business and our constitutional government will just run itself perfectly hasn't paid attention to history. We always have to be on guard. But we do know that there are accountability systems at work. I mean, the FISA court, when it was set up in the 70s, was supposed to have a very, very narrow role, which was just to approve foreign intelligence targeted warrants, just like, you know, regular judges approve regular warrants. And then after, you know, certainly after the Patriot Act and a little before that, they were supposed to be overseeing a huge bureaucracy and a huge agency, and they were removed from the ability to approve very specifically what the government was doing. Instead, they were just approving procedures. And that's when, you know, that's when there was a sea change, and suddenly, you know, the court is being pressed to do something that that court cannot do. And we have the chief judge of the FISA court saying, look, we can't do this. We're a court. We're not set up to be an oversight board over a big, you know, bustling bureaucracy. And I think that points the way towards the kinds of things we need to fix to be able to get this under control. But it's going to be a battle. The people that, you know, the forces in, you know, there is a healthy, if it's done right, a healthy tension between what law enforcement and national security people want to be able to do and what the American people and our American system of government will let them do. That's the boundary the Constitution is supposed to help us set. That's what checks and balances are supposed to help us set. But they don't get set in stone and then they just work. We're always going to have to be paying attention. And that's why I think I started with removing the secrecy, right? Because the reason that they got away with this for so long is because the American people didn't know about it.
And Cindy, if I may, I've advanced a pretty simple three-point fundamental approach to reforms of the surveillance programs. number one, that the FISA court should be completely disbanded. There is no role for a secret court with secret evidence and secret rulings in American jurisprudence. And it has been proven to be a failure where the NSA has repeatedly gamed the court, and the court knows it. And the court is offended, but there is no further recourse, as we saw. The recent attempt to appeal a FISA ruling to the Supreme Court was declined. So my feeling is that the FISA court simply has to go, and that efforts to modify it with some sort of a representative of the Fourth Amendment or the public interest would continue to window dress a secret court that has no proper role in our system. Secondly, I think that the NSA should be returned to its original mission. It can only spy outside the United States, pure and simple. And thirdly, I think that liars must be fired. And to continue to keep Keith Alexander and James Clapper in their jobs after they have perjured themselves before the Congress is just unacceptable. And those, to me, are the three fundamentals that have to be part of any meaningful reform.
I mean, I think those are all be a good start. I think that the FISA court experiment has not proven to be a very good experiment. Now, you know, look, it's not like Article III judges approving warrants in secret, and that's a one-sided process too. You know, regular warrants, you know, have been perfect, but mm-hmm. I do think that the creation of the FISA court, you know, was an experiment, and I think that doing away with it, you know, maybe it's time to try some other things to try to both protect national security. I mean, and again, nobody thinks that there aren't some secrets that the government needs to keep, especially about ongoing investigations into potential terrorists, but they've just blown that authority completely, you know, out of all proportion. So it's time to rein it back in.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the decision of Judge Leon, who was, you know, pretty strong in his statements and his rejection, based on the Fourth Amendment, of the call records collection, the metadata program, do you think that this is going to open the door to other judges who may have silenced themselves in the fear-mongering after 9/11 to step up and say, well, you know, Judge Leon is right, and in this case before my court, I'm going to embrace the Fourth Amendment?
I hope so. I think it's already done that for a lot of commentators and people who, you know, when this stuff first became public and I would go on, you know, various media or public things, and I'd say, look, I don't think this is constitutional or legal, and kind of be scoffed at by people who would just, you know, well, of course it's legal. The question is whether it's okay, or, you know, of course it's legal was the kind of starting point of every conversation I had. I'm starting to see changes now. You're starting to see people go, huh, well, maybe this Fourth Amendment thing is something we should think about. So I think that's all good. And I'm hoping that it'll also help the judiciary. I think that they tend to support each other. I think that when the public starts discussing things and feeling things, I'm sorry, there's a phone ringing here. Then, you know, it helps judges to feel, strong. And it helps them to feel like they're not out on a limb. But Judge Leon's, decision is very courageous. And I hope it will, you know, my friend Daniel Ellsberg says courage is contagious.
Cindy, one of the comments made in Judge Leon's ruling is related to the efficacy, whether all of this surveillance has the result that is claimed by the promoters, from Senator Feinstein to General Alexander. And they have cited cases that really are not very impressive, not very persuasive. And the judge himself says that he can't find any evidence advanced by the NSA that this massive dragnet program has broken up a plot or saved a life. And while I think that those are interesting arguments, fundamentally, I don't think they matter to the question, the legal question, which is at the heart of this, which is whether the government has the right to gather information on innocent people who are not suspected of any wrongdoing.
Well, I think that it's not under the First Amendment, it shouldn't be relevant at all. The question usually is, what's the scope of what you're doing with regard to what you actually need? So whether it's efficacious does come into the question about how many innocent people's information do you need in order to do what you're doing. And I think the government has not made it showing that it needs everybody's information in order to do what it's doing, that it needs to go from targeted surveillance to mass surveillance. It has not made that case. In the Fourth Amendment, the reasonableness of what the government's doing will turn a bit on the efficacy. So it's not like it doesn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. I just think that the government thinks that once it says that it stopped one terrorist attack, that we're all done. And that there is no balancing that needs to be made between how many innocent people are affected by what they're doing and their results in terms of stopping terrorist attacks before they occur, which is their stated goal.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I wouldn't want to say that it makes no difference, because I think it does make a difference. But it's not the only thing. You know, we live in the Constitution is all about striking a bargain between what law enforcement gets to do and what our rights are, and it sets some pretty clear lines, and one of those lines is that they can't have general warrants, which mm-hmm. means they can't collect everything first and then sort out second.
Cindy, I wanted to get your take on the role of the tech giants, the Silicon Valley based internet companies like Yahoo and Google and Facebook. And I am unable to really reach a clear understanding of how much they were forced by the government to participate in certain programs like PRISM and some of the others. And how much they were either forced into participation against their will or whether they freely participated and are now kind of papering that over for the benefit of their users and the privacy concerns that have been raised. And it's ironic that President Obama called a meeting of many of these executives earlier this week. He wanted to talk about the problems with healthcare.gov. They would, indulged him a little bit, but they said, we need to talk about NSA. So they seem to be getting more muscular in their approach, but I'm still not clear on to what extent they were enablers of NSA programs.
Well, it's not at all clear. I think that there's a couple things we know for sure. We know that at least some of what the NSA was doing was not with the permission of the technology companies, the kind of breaking into their data stores and accessing things abroad through either the upstreams of these companies, companies like Level 3 that provide services to companies like Google, or through just plain old breaking in to their systems. We know that I think it's fairly clear now that at least some of what the NSA was doing was not done with the permission or even the knowledge of the tech companies. I think that's part of why they're so outraged now. But we also believe that there's a chunk of what the government was doing that was with their permission, or at least their compliance, and whether that compliance was pursuant to court order or some other legal basis, or whether it was voluntary, which it appears that the phone companies certainly were participating voluntarily in the surveillance of their customers through 2008 and probably beyond. It's just not at all clear right now. It's one of the unanswered questions that we have is, how much voluntary involvement did the tech companies have? How much involvement did they have that they felt compelled to because of court orders? And how much involvement, was really, they were just a target of the NSA, just like all the rest of us, and didn't approve at all or even know of what was going on. And I suspect there's stuff in all three of those categories.
Mm-hmm.
It appears really clear that the answer at the NSA to, should we do this thing that surveils the American people was, all of the above, right? They appear to have multiple overlapping programs that got the same information in various different ways under various different legal theories. And, we American people footed the bill for all of that. But it doesn't appear that they just picked one path towards our communications and communications records, and then that was the only way they got it. They appear to have gotten the same information in multiple different ways.
Mm-hmm. But it's fair to say that they might see NSA as a competitor in the collection of information about Americans. And, of course, they're applying it commercially to try to, you know, anticipate when I'm going to buy a new car so they can serve up car ads when I open up a certain web page. But there is a little tension there because these companies have excelled in the collection of this information. And you have Eric Schmidt, the chair at Google, who also was an advisor to the Obama reelection campaign in revving up their internet usage and how to tag voters and send specific messages to them. So there are, you know, some interconnections here that I think deserve scrutiny.
I agree. I think they deserve some scrutiny. I do think that, you know, the first lesson that I would give to the companies that are doing data collection is, you know, if you build it, they will come, right? I mean, they've been collecting massive amounts of information on the American people in order to serve us ads and do other stuff for their business. But the idea that there's some bright line between that and government access is, I think, proving not to be true. And in fact, just a week or so ago, we learned that the advertising beacons, the cookies and the pinging that happen by advertising cookies are being used by the NSA to try to track people. Now, that doesn't appear to have been done with the company's knowledge, but it's the company's little beacons that they're putting on our computers that are being used by the NSA. So the line between the two is very blurry, but I wouldn't want us to lose sight of the difference, right? I mean, the last time I checked, there is no Google jail, and Google can't put you in jail, and Google can't prosecute you, and Google, you know, Google can't seize all your information, seize your house, and seize all your property, and that makes a pretty big difference between Google and the government.
I do have some friends on Facebook who claim they're in Facebook jail, but it's nothing like what
it's a little. You know, if they want to come up and spend a night in San Quentin and then see if they still want to use the jail analogy, you know, that's cool. I mean, I get metaphor; I'm a fan of it, but we shouldn't let our metaphors confuse ourselves with the reality. I think. But yes, I think that, so there is a difference between the government. I don't think that that difference means that we just turn a blind eye to what the companies are doing, but we also have to be smart about the differences so that we can prescribe the right things. But, you know, EFF has long, you know, and the other piece of this that I think could be missing in this discussion is really, really important, is that no matter what you think about the internet companies, the telecommunications companies are plainly cooperating with the government, and they have access to everything. You know, before you get to Google, you go through your ISP. Everything you do on Google goes through your ISP. And if your ISP is Verizon or AT&T or Comcast, well, I don't know so much about Comcast yet, but Sprint, I mean, you know, if you're using your mobile device and you're checking your email, Google certainly knows what you're doing, but so does your mobile carrier.
Right.
And it appears that access to your information through the telecommunications companies is happening. And if it, I'm not saying that we should let the internet companies off the hook. I think it's important to pay attention to them as well. But I worry that all this focus on Google and Prism and the, you know, the sexy internet companies is making us lose sight of this huge other hole in our data stream.
I'll just point out that it was revealed a few months ago that the CIA pays AT&T more than $10 million a year for international calling records. And that's separate from the NSA collection program. And this leads to my last question for you, Cindy. That is, this year we've had a very appropriate and heavy focus on the aggressive and unconstitutional operations of the NSA. But Shahid Buttar, who is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, wrote an essay recently pointing out that the FBI is an extremely rogue agency that is conducting surveillance as well as violating our constitutional rights in other ways. And there are another 15 or 16 agencies arrayed under the Director of National Intelligence, and none of those has received any special scrutiny along the lines of what we've seen the NSA get this year. And so how do we manage this? Because there are so many secrets and secrets about secrets that it's dizzying, but fixing the NSA doesn't do diddly about the Defense Intelligence Agency or the other tentacles of our intelligence community.
I think that's exactly right. That's why I kind of end up in a constant question in the point where I want to start with a constitutional interpretation, right? Because that says the government shall not. The government shall not conduct mass surveillance. And the FBI's Hemisphere program is very, very troubling. The all of the other agencies that appear to be doing some kind of surveillance. If we try to do a piecemeal solution to this mass surveillance problem, then we're going to leave holes. And I think we need to have a solution that says mass surveillance is not constitutional in a democratic society like the United States. That's what I actually think the Fourth Amendment already says. So we don't have to change the Constitution here. We just have to go back to what it was when the framers wrote it. And the thing about the Fourth Amendment is that it was written exactly in response to surveillance, mass surveillance without individual targeting. That's what general warrants were. And if you read your history, and there's a famous guy named James Otis, who was one of the founders of this country, who railed against general warrants. And if you read what he wrote, it could have been written last week. So that's why I spend a lot of my energy in the courts, because I think that the way to fix this is a constitutional way. Now, Congress can do it too, but Congress has to do something that's not piecemeal and tiny. It has to do something that's broad. And we've done it before. I mean, the Wiretap Act says, there's really easy ways to say, notwithstanding any other law, it shall be illegal in this country to conduct mass surveillance. We have lots of laws that start with notwithstanding any other laws. It's time that we got one about mass surveillance.
Well, I want to make sure that people have heard you loudly and clearly on this important point you made about the eternal vigilance, and that no matter what victories we get and we gained out there in the court or in Congress, we have, as people, we have this short attention span and we believe in quick fixes. Okay, it's fixed. Now I can just turn around and go and just live my life. And that it doesn't happen that way. Life doesn't happen, and certainly not within the governance and politics. This is not the case. This has never been the case. And that no matter what, we must maintain our eternal vigilance when it comes to these very, very, very important liberties-related issues.
Yep, that's exactly right. Thank you. You put it very well.
Cindy Cohn. She's the legal director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org. Keep fighting.
Thank you very much.
On us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.